and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I am Adam A. Donaldson, your host, and joining me today is...
Candace LaPage.
And this is Candace's second show. You're our first returning co-host.
Ooh, yeah.
So it's... it's exciting.
It is exciting. On the third time, I get a belt, right? That's how it goes?
Oh, yeah, right. I gotta write that down. Get belts. Yeah. Anyway. I almost said open sources. This is what happens when you do two shows a week. End Credits is a locally sourced movie show for local movie fans, and we are here every Wednesday at 8 a.m. to talk about the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the Bayhem of Transformers The Last Night. That will be in the back half of the show, though. For the first half, we're going to do something special for the upcoming Canada Day festivities. And we're going to talk about some of our favorite Canadian films. So, ladies first, I always say, Candace, why don't you throw me a title, one of your favorite Canadian films?
Sure. Well, I wasn't sure how we were going to do this, you know, if there was like a ranking order. So I figure because I actually went with the theme, I should start by talking about the film that created the theme.
Excellent.
So
you did way more prep than I did. I just looked at a bunch of my favorites and I looked up on Netflix and old reviews,
yeah,
I've done. So
well, believe
kudos
me,
to you for doing the homework.
I did that too. But the reality is that my favorite horror film, mm-hmm, of all time is Black Christmas.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a Canadian film.
Mm-hmm.
And since horror is my favorite genre, then that you should extrapolate that into this is obviously my favorite Canadian film of all time.
Right?
I mean, that makes... That sounds right.
Sounds right to me.
Black Christmas, my favorite Canadian film of all time, happens to be in the horror genre, which is my very favorite genre. And so I decided, though there are a plethora of really good Canadian films, and I spy a couple of them on your list there, you're going to bring...
no copying!
You're going to bring probably a little more artistic value to this conversation. I'm bringing lot of schlock, because I decided to just stick with the theme horror. I chose five horror films to talk about.
All right.
So, Black Christmas. Have you seen it?
I have seen Black Christmas.
Oh my gosh.
I rewatched it this past Christmas, actually.
I rewatch it every Christmas, roughly, pretty much.
Yeah, it was, I think it was shot in Toronto.
It was, yeah. So it was shot in Toronto and mostly actually set sort of like right on campus.
Yeah.
And it's just the quality of actors in this film is amazing.
Yeah.
So people who went on to do many great things, like Olivia Hussey, who, mm-hmm, is the star of the film, mm-hmm, Margot Kidder, she was in a little movie. I don't know, played a little side role.
Yeah, yeah.
John Saxon, who continued his horror genre work by going on to be the father on Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yep.
Art Hindle, who is just...
Canadian royalty.
Another one of those princes in Canadian cinema. Yeah. Wearing, may I say, an amazing fur coat in this film.
Yes, he does have an awesome fur coat in the movie.
Yeah, this film was made in 1974. That is the time when it was okay for men to wear full-length fur coats.
Also before when fur was murder.
Well, yeah, but I mean, technically it was murder then also.
Very true. Before you could say it.
Yeah.
I hear you, though.
Yeah, so Black Christmas, directed by Bob Clark, also known for Porky's.
Christmas Story.
Yeah, he's kind of been all over the place. Clearly, Christmas is a theme.
Very true. Yes.
Yeah.
Porky's also, I think, technically a Canadian movie.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. So...
Yeah, there are a lot of, I don't know because I live here, so I think that there are films, and I do a podcast about Canadian music also, but things that just are in our psyche,
mm-hmm,
because we're here, and so they're always there, and I don't really know if people go to other places, like in the States, and Black Christmas is as popular of a film there as it was here. I assume it must be fairly popular because it was remade in 2006 or something.
Yeah, I remember, the only thing I remember about it was like Mary Elizabeth Winstead's early days.
Yes.
And so this was like around the time where she was like in Final Destination and then, mm-hmm, she was in Grindhouse. And then I remember Carrie Fisher was the headmistress in that one.
Oh, yes, she was. That's, yeah. Yep.
And the thing about the difference with the Black Christmas remake, I think it sort of purposely made a lot of the female sorority characters bitchy. Whereas if you go back and watch the original Black Christmas, they're just regular girls. And...
Yeah. So not only are they regular, this is one of the things I love about this film, is that it was made in 1974, and the women in this film are are acting and making decisions that would not be uncommon right now in 2017, right? The main character, Olivia Hussey, her and her boyfriend, they're very, very serious. They accidentally get pregnant, mm-hmm. and she decides that she's going to have an abortion. And that's sort of, you know, her big plot story the whole time is that she wants to have an abortion. Her boyfriend doesn't want to. He's willing to give up his music career and you know, we're going to get married and we'll raise the kid and it'll be great. And she's like, no, I don't want you to give up your career. I don't want to give up my career. Like, I'm, you know. So in 1974, she's making this decision. And it's not an after school special.
No.
That the way they treat it. They just treat it as, this is just a woman who's making a decision.
And it's not exploitative either because it's the height of Roe v. Wade. I think that was the year of Roe v. Wade, actually.
Yeah, yeah. And then Margot Kidder's character, who, by the way, she just looks drop-dead gorgeous in this film. It's amazing. It's amazing. I think she just looks so good. She is probably the character that most represents what in the remake they made them all like this.
Yeah.
Right, where she's just strong, outspoken, kind of she has this interesting sentence where she talks about how you can't rape a townie.
Right. I do remember that.
So it's not that she's not against her own power and all the women that she's with. She thinks that they're all amazing, wonderful women who can go on to do a bunch of things. But she very much thinks that there's a class divide.
There's a class. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. Class divide.
Yeah.
That's a great pick. I'm going to choose, like you said, I'm going to go super arty right off the bat. This is one I saw in 2010 at the Toronto Film Festival, and it was in the NFB. I don't think they still do screenings at the NFB because I think they closed the screening room. It was one of the cuts under Harper, but at the time they would have TIFF media and industry screenings, and so this was it was me in a room with like about maybe six other people, including Richard Schiff of The West Wing, by the way.
Ooh.
He was sitting there at the back, but it's called Modra. And you might not have heard the director. Her name is Ingrid Veniger. And this was her first movie. It's super low budget. Mm-hmm. It is sort of super realistic. I would not say it was Dogma 95, but it's very much along those lines. The two main characters are a pair of teens from the Toronto area. The young girl, her name is Luca. She's going to Slovakia for a couple of weeks. Her family's from Slovakia. Her boyfriend sort of inexplicably breaks up with her, and he was going to go with her. And then a boy who admires her from school kind of gets wind of this breakup and swoops in for the opportunity. So he tries to go in and ask her for a movie. Instead, she says, "Well, why don't you come to Slovakia with me?" And that sounds like a setup for a romantic comedy, but it's not. I mean, certainly there's romance to it, and certainly there's some drama to it and some comedy moments, but it comes from a very sweet place and also from a very genuine place. And the actors in it are so naturalistic. I think it's just both of them. The girl who plays Lucas was Vinegar's daughter, so casting at home. And so I think they're both movie roles, so that probably helps. But it also helps that the script is very down to earth, and they don't put words into their mouths. It's sort of sound like they were written by someone who was university educated. There's a scene where she asks the boy, like, what does he know about Slovakia? And he's like, well, I know they have a great hockey team. And the way he says it is is like he's trying to impress her. It's like, I know one thing about Slovakia, huh? And she's like, yeah, okay, well, you're gonna see some things. And but the scenes like that would be something totally a Canadian teenage boy would say, mm-hmm. and trying to show off what limited knowledge he has of Slovakia. So I do want to kind of give people hints of where they could find these too, as well, mm-hmm. as we go along, because I think part of the reason it's worth having this conversation is to highlight good Canadian movies, but to also tell people where they could find them, because they don't come to the galaxy.
No.
Or
no,
either
sure
galaxy.
Don't.
So I know Black Christmas is on Shudder, which is the horror movie streaming service, and you can get that in Canada now. And Modra, I know for a fact is on Bell On Demand right now, and but you can probably also find it on iTunes.
Yeah, I think, I mean, iTunes tends to carry everything, which is nice, if you don't mind.
iTunes has a really good Canadian movie section, too, and I do try to highlight that around the in April when it's like Canadian Film Month, or I know Canadian Film Day is in April, but yeah, so it, Mojo should be relatively easy to find if you want to check it out.
Great. All right, bringing it back down again, back down the artistic level.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to talk about 1980s Prom Night.
Oh yeah.
Starring a fresh from Halloween, Jamie Lee Curtis.
That's right.
And Leslie Nielsen as her father.
It was he? Well, he. I guess he would have been fresh from Airplane at that point. Or was there was Police Squad on them?
Police Squad, probably.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, because I think Airplane also came out in 1980, maybe?
You might be right. Yeah. Yeah. You might be right.
Yeah, so directed by Paul Lynch. I'm not really sure that he's done much since. I didn't really... I don't recognize the name. I didn't follow the link.
He's not that Lynch.
Yeah. No,
he's
no.
The lesser Lynch, unfortunately.
It's a different Lynch.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Prom Night, I think, is... It's a pretty important film in Canadian horror.
Mm-hmm.
And interestingly, we just talked about Black Christmas and how they did a remake of it. And there's a couple other films here that I talk about. There's another one that they've also done a remake of. Mm-hmm. But Prom Night, I think there's 5 Prom Nights, right? So this created a whole franchise of films. And not only that, it's just a really very typical sort of slasher idea. Someone, you know, a group of kids accidentally, while they were playing, killed someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 6 years later on prom night, the person and or someone comes for revenge. Right.
Yeah.
This is a story that you then see over and over and over again.
Not explained why he chose prom night, but...
Well, because that was actually the day that...
Right, it was the anniversary.
It's the anniversary of the death.
Pure coincidence.
It is pure coincidence. You know, they didn't... well, who knows? I don't know. Leslie Nielsen plays the high school principal.
And yeah.
Maybe he... Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this film is not... it's not fantastic. Frankly, growing up, I preferred Prom Night 2 myself for the actual sort of...
Interesting choice.
...horror, you know, if I was going for one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
But this one is just... it's so disco-friendly. It's really, you know, and if you want to see Jamie Lee Curtis, really, I think now we know that Jamie Lee Curtis is basically capable of anything.
Yeah.
She's just amazing. But in, you know, 1980, I think people, you know, what is she? She was in that film. She screamed a lot. She's Janet Leigh's daughter. Okay, whatever. And now we get to see her do her dance moves. Because there's an extended there's an extended dance-off in this film, which is amazing, which we will see again in the future in Staying Alive.
That's right.
When she, yeah.
You're right about Jamie Lee Curtis, and I don't say this jokingly. She had a great run on NCIS. She was like a character on for like an arc on NCIS, and she was great.
Well, and currently she's on Scream Queens.
That's right, too, yeah.
And... She's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
She's so funny. She looks great. She's just, she's great.
She is great. I will give you that. I'm going to go dipping in the horror pool with a movie called Pontypool.
And also on my list.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Well, I won't steal your thunder too much, but it will also allow me to dip into another Stephen McHattie film. I love Pontypool. It's a zombie movie without zombies, and I'll get into the rest of it later. But if you want to see another great Stephen McHattie performance, and Stephen McHattie's kind of a local.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. He doesn't live in Guelph, but he lives in like one of the little towns around Guelph because he does. You can spot him in town from time to time. But he also played the coach in this movie called Score, the hockey musical.
Oh, I haven't had a chance to see that yet.
And I don't know what took so long for some Canadian filmmaker to put together hockey and musical into one thing, but they did. I mean, it's really nothing special in terms of like the music. The music is, I was trying to remember a song from it. I mean, this was 7 years ago I saw it too, but I would be hard pressed to remember a song. I could play the soundtrack and go, oh, that was a song in it. But I love the two leads in it. They were both kind of unknowns, but they were so earnest and they were so talented. And there's a ton of wicked cameos in it. It's got Strombo in it. John McDermott has a cameo. He's singing "O Canada" at a game. Oh. Nelly Furtado is in it. Walter Gretzky and Theo Fleury to like bring the hockey yep. flavor. And Hawksley Workman has a cameo. And then Olivia Newton-John as well.
Oh, well, so, yeah, that makes sense.
So, I mean, this just runs the gamut. And it comes from a filmmaker, Michael McGowan, who also did another Canadian film, One Week, which starred Joshua Pacey Jackson.
Great. Joshua Pacey Jackson. Yes. Yes. He could be Joshua Peter Jackson also.
Well, I think Pacey hangs around his neck a little bit more than Fringe, yeah. but... But I don't disagree because I like Fringe a lot. Mm-hmm. It's just really a joyful movie. It combines like, you know, great two things Canadians excel, which is music and hockey, into one really great package. It's a lot of fun, I found, and I'm not someone who likes musicals or hockey really. So the fact that it's kind of able to suck me in despite its sort of creative deficiencies, I give it high praise for. And it's just a lot of fun. And Steve McHattie is in it. He plays the coach of the Brampton Blades, which is a faux OHL team. I don't know if they use the OHL in it or they use like a faux OHL. The long story short, yeah. There is no Brampton OHL team now anyway. But he's so great. You know, it's the classic like frazzled coach who's like always yelling and hollering at you and throwing his clipboard down. But then, you know, he has his moments of genuine insight too. And of course, it's like Stephen McHattie, who has got this raspy, grizzly voice, and
yeah.
he's just such a great actor. And I like how he's like one of these guys that you see in the Canadian film business who can like mm-hmm. turn up in like a Roland Emmerich movie. Like he was in 2012. He was like one yeah. of the ARC ship captains.
Yep. Yep.
And but he can also do stuff like this. And as much as I'd like to say, you know, he should be a bigger star, maybe he should. But I love him as a little character actor that turns up mm-hmm. in all these types of roles. And yep. but Score the Hockey Musical, I enjoyed a lot.
All right. Should we just go on to Pontypool?
Yeah, let's do Pontypool.
All right. Yes, so Pontypool is on my list. It's the newest film on my list. And potentially, outside of Black Christmas, potentially actually the scariest film. Because mm-hmm. I love this film because nothing happens, but it's yeah. just dreadful the entire time. You're just in this constant state of dread going, oh my God, oh my God, what's going to happen? Oh my God, what's going to happen? There is some release right towards the end. We start to, you know, things kind of hit the fan pretty well, but yeah. even then it's still so small, right? Yeah. It's essentially just three actors and a voice actor, like a, yep. a fourth person, right? That's mm-hmm. that's it, the entire film. It's not only that, I haven't finished the book, but I started reading the book Pontypool by Tony uh-huh. Burgess, who, by the way, makes a cameo in the movie, and I didn't realize until I rewatched it this week.
Mm-hmm. Is he one of the voices?
No, there's one part where the singing troupe come in.
Right.
And they do some singing, and he plays the sort of leader of the singing troupe. It's the only time we really see any other actors in the film at all, and they're all just sort of cameo people.
Okay.
But I started reading the book, and I haven't quite finished it yet, but what's interesting, of course, is that this movie, and I think this is what Bruce McDonald does best, is that he makes films out of books by not actually telling the story of the book, but the story around the book.
Yeah.
Right? Because this character, all of this stuff in the radio station, this isn't what the book is about. The book is actually about when, you know, the people who are out in the streets and what's going on. And so
it's the exact opposite
yeah,
of the book.
Yeah. So the film, all we're getting is just the, like, essentially our own viewing in to what's going on in this town, because the people in the film are basically us. Mm-hmm. They're just stuck in a radio station. They have no idea what's going on outside. All they're getting is a little bit of, you know, some phone calls, some things. Yeah. They don't even look out a window.
Yeah, it's kind of like a basement studio, yeah, so there's not yeah. really a window. And I think there's a blizzard during it,
yeah.
so it's like doubly claustrophobic. And one of the things I like about it is the cause for the zombification of people, where it's kind of like this this language virus, mm-hmm. or viral language.
Yeah.
And not to spoil it, but it is like maybe 10 years old at this point. But, you know, they basically have to talk out of the contagion. That's how you sort of cure yourself, is to basically talk it out. And thinking about this movie and thinking about where we are politically and with the discourse now, it feels so interesting to think about the theme of this movie, where language is a virus that can turn you into a monster.
Yeah.
And I would love to go back and rewatch this now, sort of with that subtext that we're seeing, particularly down south, but up in Canada as well. This idea that, you know, just saying the words, or saying words, turns you into a monster that will, you know, kill people you're with, and then how you have to turn around and make language a cure to stop yourself from that becoming that monstrous.
Yeah, it's an interesting and unique sort of way of not only telling a zombie story, but also the sort of origin, like what is causing this.
Mm-hmm. And I when I worked at Thomas, I tried to, you know, people would come in and, you know, looking for something scary, I'd be like, you should do that, you should watch this. It's a zombie movie without zombies. And, you know, because sometimes people are skittish about gore and things.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's great. And I highly recommend it. And that's another one that's pretty easy to find. I know it's on iTunes right now, too. I think I'm going to go artsy fartsy again. and I'm going to go old. I'm going to go old too. This is from the 70s. It's called Going Down the Road.
Oh, yes.
And it's artistically and technically, it's not the greatest movie, but it does capture a period in time. It's about these two friends who come to Toronto from out east. They're looking for work. And this is something that actually happened in the 70s a lot. There wasn't a lot of work out in the East Coast, so people would come into the country and find work. And, you know, it's sort of like, it's not day in the life of, I mean, it's like a couple of years in the life of, and these guys who come to Toronto, find work, and they're making money. So, you know, they're out on Yonge Street. And of course, Yonge Street at this time was utter and complete dive town.
Yeah.
You know, there's a reason kind of Zanzibar is on Yonge Street. It's been there for a while, and it's, you know, and there's a reason why you find in the midst of now all these quirky little shops and artisanal places, and you still get like a couple of divey record stores in Zanzibar along there. And this kind of shows you why. It's a really great time capsule of Toronto in that period. But it's also really well acted, too. The two actors, whose names I forgot to look up, sorry. They bounce out really well off each other. I'm not sure how much of it was scripted and how much of it was maybe improvised a little. I think there was some of that in
there. Yeah, it felt like very natural speech patterns.
Yeah.
So it does seem like it was...
And there's a scene where one of them gets a woman pregnant and he ends up marrying her, and there's a scene where he's clearly drunk at the reception, and he's kind of like saying things that are making everyone uncomfortable, and a scene like that where it kind of goes on uncomfortably long. I do wonder how much of that particular scene was maybe improvised, because it makes your skin crawl watching it, but it's so well acted. And what's interesting thing about this is I hadn't heard of it until a couple of years ago when they actually made a sequel. They made a sequel called Down the Road Again, and it's about the one of them is still alive. The other actor unfortunately passed. So it's about him, and it's about, you know, him trying to reconnect with his daughter and trying not to repeat some of the same mistakes. But it's also it almost feels a bit out of time, even though it was made a couple of years ago. Just the style of it seems a bit out of time. But I found it an effective sequel, especially in, you know, this day and age where we're seeing a lot of sequels to like 20, 30, 40 year old movies. This felt, you know, that it struck the right tone. It took the story in new directions while also being very clearly referential to the previous edition.
So that leads pretty well into my next film, because will admit that Going Down the Road is one of those films. I'm not sure if I've ever watched the entire thing from beginning to end. I've watched bits and pieces of it. But of course, what I have seen is the SCTV parody.
That's right.
What's funny is that I have such strong memories of the SCTV parody that there are times that I think, which one is in my head? Am I thinking of the movie or am I thinking of the parody? So SCTV leads into my next film, which is Cannibal Girls.
Nice.
By Ivan Reitman. Yep. This is starring Eugene Levy and Andrea Martin.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very early times for them, 1973. And 75 to 80% of this dialogue was all improvised. Of course, these are two Second City improvisational actors.
Yep.
The film is interesting. So I won't say that it's good, but I also won't say that it's bad. I love it. I think that it's super fun. I can't really say what they were trying to do with it at the time. It kind of is a little bit of a mix of so many things because you have these two improv actors. And even, Ivan Reitman, obviously, probably most well-known for Ghostbusters, which is, again, a bunch of improvisational comedy actors,
and also like Stripes
kind of
and Meatballs,
like comedy
same crew.
Horror type yeah. sort of thing, right?
Yeah.
So this was sort of set to be kind of this really like schlocky gore. Roger Corman Pictures actually picked it up to distribute it,
yeah.
but it doesn't actually provide that as much because it's so much just Eugene Levy and Andrea Martin, riffing off each other.
Yeah.
yeah. And again, Eugene Levy in a beautiful full length fur white coat. Again, 1973, 1974, this is the time when men wore fur coats.
I think that came into use again on SCTV. I'm not sure if it was in his newscaster identity. I can't remember that character's name, but
oh yeah.
It was Floyd.
Yeah,
Floyd, and I can't remember, but I remember that coat appearing on the show. So I'm not sure if that came from Eugene Levy's personal.
It might have
wardrobe.
Been his own wardrobe. Yeah, who knows? Yeah, no, the film itself is, it is sort of a kind of fun, horror-y sort of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
They have a flat tire or something. They have to go into this strange town they don't know. It's a bunch of small town people, and everybody seems to be in on this weird conspiracy.
Mm-hmm.
So again, not the most original of plots, but that's the great thing about horror is that you just sort of start with that very easy thing, and then
yeah, and
magic
also
happens.
Also, not to be confused with Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah, no, very, very different.
What was your last title? We're unfortunately running out a bit long, but
my last title is My Bloody Valentine.
Oh, nice.
Again, just another very similar, right? You just put all the teens in a party together, and someone is out to commit revenge for an accident that happened, 20 years ago.
Also remade 20 years later.
Exactly. And set 100% in the Sydney mines of Nova Scotia, and not only filmed there, but also set there, which is really unique.
I'm going to throw my last plug for The Trotsky, which is a Jacob Tiernan comedy. It's about a kid who thinks he's the reincarnation of Leon Trotsky. It's so great. Jay Baruchel is hilarious in it.
Mm-hmm.
It is probably the most pro-communist film you'll ever see, and I mean that as a compliment. I mean, it's great working class sort of hero comedy, but set in a high school. And like I said, Jay Baruchel's great. The line to beat, I think, in comedy the last 10 years is, "Are you my Stalin, Dwight?" and the way it's delivered, it is hilarious. So that is a little repertory Canadian cinema for you, and we hope you found it enlightening, and maybe over the long weekend you get a chance to check out some of these fine Canadian films. I don't know how you might feel about Candace's horror marathon, but I think worth checking out. Anyway, we do have another movie to review this week, and in thinking about music for the show, in a show reviewing Transformers last night, there was only really one song I could think of. You got the touch! You got the power! Yeah! Yeah! We're going to review Transformers The Last Knight after this break. You are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. Take
We have guests.
Oh,
what's the matter with you?
Oh, shit, my bits are falling off.
Edward,
what the hell?
Who's this kid there?
Good God. Master, he's a complete knucklehead.
I'm awfully sorry about that, but, you see, he thinks it's still the year 1918 or 1914, something like that, isn't it? I mean, it's late onset of, well, robot dementia. Not at all pretty.
Well, I don't know what you're smoking in that pipe, man, but what's going on here? Will you drag me to some transformer retirement home?
Mm-hmm.
Look, somebody better start talking. I'm out of here.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Okay. Bumblebee, we only met when I was a little boy in short pants. I must have been that tall, maybe taller, or maybe shorter. I can't remember. But...
You?
Face.
Hey, you know this guy?
Oh, yeah. Let's have a look at this thing. Please. Very interesting. Yes. You keep a secret for so long, knowing it to be true, and yet deep down inside, you begin to wonder, has my life been wasted? Have you ever felt like that, Mr. Cade?
It's just Cade. Look, old timer, I don't have a ton of patience for riddles right now.
Yes, but you want to know, don't you, dude?
And that dude was Transformers The Last Night. It's the paradoxic fifth installment of Fighting Robot Cars, and it is directed by Michael Bay and stars Mark Wahlberg, Josh Duhamel, Laura Haddock, Isabel Moner, and Sir Anthony Dude Hopkins.
He's beautiful.
You know what? I'll start off by saying he was one of the best parts of this movie because I don't know if he was high. I don't know if he was auditioning to be Doctor Who.
No.
Because he's just kind of, he's like this bouncing ball. And I don't want to get into the plot because I'm not sure there is one, but there's a scene where he goes to 10 Downing Street where the Prime Minister of Britain
yes.
lives. And he's like, hey, police officers, what's up? I want to meet the Prime Minister. And they're like, get out of here, old guy. And he's like, sure, no problem. I'll just use the side entrance. And
yeah.
he wanders off and...
comes in some secret entrance. And
and then, he's there in the Prime Minister's office and the Prime Minister's like, security. And security comes in. He's like, don't come any closer. I got this watch. It killed Hitler.
Well, and I love that little clip that you played when mm-hmm. he starts off by talking about the robot dementia.
Yeah.
The actual, his little monologue there goes on forever.
Yeah.
So when Marky Mark comes out saying, I don't know what you're smoking in that pipe, like, literally, I wonder how much of that, like, did they just roll the camera and go, just do what you like,
just
Sir
say
Hopkins.
What you want.
Just,
yeah.
you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And, I think that he showed up and was just like, you know what? I know what's going on. I'll just fill in. I'll just fill in what needs to be filled in. Don't worry about it.
I do wonder what was in the pipe. Also, I'm not sure where to begin with this. I mean, let me just say, you when we were talking about this,
yeah.
you were saying you're a Michael Bay apologist, and
yes.
I totally get that because
yeah.
Michael Bay does do good things. Like, I watched 13 Hours. 13 Hours
mm-hmm.
is a great movie. Not great, but it's great for what it should have been. I thought mm-hmm. it was going to be a total disaster because of all the politics of Benghazi and all that,
yeah.
but it's a really well-done movie. So was his last non-Transformers movie, Pain mm-hmm. and Gain,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was really well done as well, and it sort of fit his tone and what he wants to do. I think the difference is with both those movies and with a lot of his earlier movies is like he's given restraints. He's given a
yeah.
set budget. When
yeah.
he does these Transformers movies, he has a blank check.
Oh, yeah.
And so he can just do whatever and
yeah.
away we go.
Yes. And do whatever he did. I mean, I watched this film and went, oh, look, Michael Bay finally got to make a medieval war film.
Yeah.
Oh, look, Michael Bay finally got to make a submarine film. Oh, look, Michael Bay finally got to make a World War II film. Oh, look.
Yeah.
Look.
Yeah.
Like, there is almost nothing he didn't do in this film. And
yeah.
again, like Sir Anthony Hopkins just showing up and going, I'm just going to have a good time. Michael Bay's like, I mean, people gave me money, told me I could do whatever I wanted, so I did.
It is the Dr. Nick Riviera approach to filmmaking. The best part is when they gave me the money. The problem I have with this film and the last film as well was that it seemed like a really great collection of ideas. There were about three mm-hmm. different screenplays in the last
yeah.
film that could have just made their own separate movie, but he shoved them all into the same burlap sack
mm-hmm.
and then beat them against a tree. And then in this one too, it's right, you know, it starts out and first of all, I still don't understand why technologically advanced artificial life forms are coming to a planet with no technology.
That was, the answer to that was given in the film, and I won't spoil it.
I don't buy
it's
it.
Also,
I still don't buy it.
It's also the setup for the next film.
And that's something else, because I was watching a commercial last night, and then they have a commercial for it. And it's like, it's the final chapter. And I was like, no, I saw this Thursday night, and there's a mid-credit scene that clearly indicates this is not the final chapter.
Yes. No. It's, I mean, I'm pretty sure, in fact, that the last words of the film are, this is not the end of the story.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think Optimus Prime does say that.
Yeah.
That's another thing with this movie. Optimus Prime.
Story.
Well, no, it just, it seems like there's really no kind of Optimus Prime. I have a number of problems with how he's characterized throughout the course of this movie.
Yes.
He's been like slowly getting more sociopathic as these movies. Like, he flat out murders Kelsey Grammer in Age of Extinction.
That's right.
and then in this movie, he's barely a presence at all. They show him in like little small scenes, and then he comes back for like the big concluding final fight at the end.
Yeah.
And which is a weird way to treat your main character who's been a part of this thing the whole time. And on top of that, you have this new character played by Isabella Moner, who's this young girl. Which I think is a fairly positive direction for a series that you can probably count the number of female characters who haven't been highly sexualized.
Yeah, I do think this film dealt with women a lot better.
I'll get to that.
Yeah,
but there's the Isabella Moner character I liked a lot, where she's like this kind of this orphan girl who's lost her parents in a Transformers attack, which, you know, again, it's kind of a neat touch because it deals with the real world consequences of these big Titanic Transformers fights. But then she disappears for half the movie.
I would watch her movie,
right?
And it would be a little, you know, it could be just a small movie. Like, let's talk about how she met Squeaks and Canopy, and you know how she became friends with these Transformers.
Right. And there's a scene where she loses one of them, and it's almost a genuinely touching scene. Because it involves these, you know, army guys who are like part of the Transformers hunter killer squad or whatever. I would have liked that if it had been about her and Mark Wahlberg's character.
Yeah.
And we were talking about this after the show last week. I like the idea of Mark Wahlberg being the star of this franchise, because I like the idea of like a blue collar inventor dude who's just trying to get by, working with his hands. That seems to fit with the oeuvre of Transformers. And I think that fits with the cartoon, because I think the main human character, there was a father and his son, and I think he was a mechanic of some kind.
Yeah.
So it fits in well. You have robot cars and he's a mechanic. Okay, so that's fine. The other thing is they do introduce another main female character in it, played by Laura Hadcock. There's a scene in the movie where she comes, Anthony Hopkins gathers her and Mark Wahlberg, and she comes in and she's wearing like the most figure flattering dress you could possibly pour her into.
Yes.
And Mark Wahlberg makes a line about her wearing a stripper dress, and I'm like, okay, the last time we saw her, she literally looked like the Professor Strippergram, where she was like hip-hugging pencil skirt, 12-inch heels, the shirt that was
heels.
Open just shy of being, you know, rated R, and her hair was in a severe bun and she was wearing horn rim glasses. That was the that was her in her stripper dress.
Yeah.
And I, as much as I appreciate this idea that we're going to introduce female characters who bring something to the plot other than being the object of affection and have to be rescued by the men characters in the Transformers, it's still just falls into Michael Bay's worst instincts about how women walk and talk and act and dress, because I have not
you've never met a woman like that? Is that what you're trying to say?
What I'm trying to say is, having spent a lot of time on a university campus, I have not seen a woman dress like that.
But this was at Oxford.
I don't think that makes it better.
I do think so. I actually really liked her character.
I liked her too.
As a woman, I will say, that I had no problem with the choices of outfits that they put her in because she owned them. And she very much, you know, when I did see her the very beginning when she walks out of the car in those heels, and I was like, is this going to be a joke about how a ridiculous woman wore these heels on these cobblestone things? No, she navigated it, carrying a cup of coffee, didn't spill a thing. I'm like, oh, okay.
Fair enough.
Actually, this is her real life. This is how she chooses to dress for work all the time, despite the fact that that's a cobblestone street that she has to park on and come to work in.
Mm-hmm.
And then the same thing with that dress, which, by the way, where did that dress come from?
Thank you. Yes.
That she was had my question.
She had five costume changes in the mission.
Like, I don't understand why she needed to... Well, maybe she had grass stains on her other outfit because she was in a fight with her car.
Yeah. She gets kidnapped by her car.
Hot Rod.
Hot Rod.
Yes, I don't really understand the joke. Like, why was it? Why did he have a French accent? And why did they just keep saying Hot Rod in French with a French accent? It was kind of a...
That's another debate altogether. Yeah. Why alien robots have, like, Earth stereotypical characteristics. Because we meet an other Transformer in this who is, like, a black gangster rapper archetype. If we're going to be generous about how we're going to describe this, I would say stereotype. But I mean, this has to be like the sixth Transformer we've met that is, you know, a black man inside a robot.
Yeah. Though I will say that generally speaking, I found the gross racial stereotypes much less in this film. And generally, when they were making gross racial stereotypes, they were towards the Brits. And or the Americans.
Yeah, that's
right?
Good.
Like,
yeah.
Okay, so the same thing, right? With giving a little bit more power to the female character, putting words in her mouth where she, you know, sure, you can sexualize my outfit, but how about I take it off instead?
Yeah.
Like, is that going to make you a little more comfortable? Which was a great line. I really loved it. So giving the women a little bit more power and a little bit more, ability to actually take part in the action and have a role in the action, and then also the giving the just curbing the racial stereotypes. I was like, okay, clearly he's getting some notes from people that he is actually paying attention to, or it's just right? Like, this is all stuff that everybody's talking about. So I mean, Michael Bay is very much of his time. So
1947, and I agree. I liked her as an actress a lot. I liked what she brought to it. I thought she was feisty in the right ways, and she did not come across as someone pretending to be a professor. You know, you do feel like she's a professor character, and you're right about, because not to get into too spoilery territory, but there's a scene in the climax where the army men are like, okay, this is it, mission's over, and she's the one who's like, no, the mission. Not over.
Yeah.
And she goes back to help the Transformers. I want to talk about other sort of stereotypes. Tony Hale, who I think we're both Arrested Development fans.
Yes. Yeah.
Are you a Veep fan? Have you watched Veep?
I watched a little bit of Veep.
Okay.
And
I haven't watched Veep yet, but I mean,
he's great.
He is great. But one of the problems I had in Transformers, the last one, there's a scene where Stanley Tucci's like trying to figure out what's wrong with these Transformers he's building, and he's like, we're supposed to be scientists, and he starts smacking this blackboard, and he's like, algorithms, math, what's going on? And it's more of this this in this, because Tony Hale plays like some sort of scientist who's, and there's a scene in near the end where they're describing like the pending Armageddon, and he says it's like a microwave effect, it's like the Earth is going to be a Jiffy Pop bag in a microwave, and I'm like, you don't microwave Jiffy Pop. And I almost said that
really?
Out loud in the theater.
That was your problem with that line? My problem with that whole line was, I don't care, we all know we're going to die, what are you doing about it? Like, why are you yelling at me about how I'm going to die? We're all on board. We know.
Yeah.
Stop yelling about how it's happening and tell me what are our solutions? Like, he was so insistent in telling everybody all of the ways they were going to die. I'm like, what? I don't understand what your purpose is. What is your purpose? Well, exposition is your purpose. I understand.
Yeah.
But
you're right. But it's all part of the same problem, is that I guess the screenwriters didn't feel compelled to like even technobabble their way out of it.
And why should they? Let me put on my Michael Bay apologist. Okay.
Okay.
Who goes to see a Transformers film and expects a story, expects science, expects expects the plot to actually make sense. Expect it to not have giant holes, like where Cade says to, and I don't remember her name, but the younger girl, and says, "Oh, you got my message and you brought the troops." I'm like, there was no message. He never gave it. That was obviously sent to the cutting room floor. This never happened, right? They're having this giant climax on a floating piece of land, I think. I think. I don't really know because I couldn't tell where they were.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. All I wanted to see was robots fighting. I don't understand why anybody goes to a Transformers film and then comes out with all these complaints about this stuff that nobody ever pretended was going to be there or well explained or taken care of.
No, but here's the thing, though. They bring back Josh Duhamel's character, who's
who,
like,
I love. Sorry, that was just a Josh Duhamel.
That's fine. You're allowed.
That just happens. It happens.
You're allowed. He was in the first three films. They skipped his character in the fourth, but they bring him back, and I don't understand why. Because there's kind of like really no reference to anything that happened in those first three films. Other
Do you
than
know why? It's because women like me wanted more eye candy in these films.
All right. Well, that's fair. But I mean, just story-wise, again, I acknowledge what you said, but it just highlights the problem, I think, when with the character development in these movies and the plot and everything, is that you can bring back a character who you're supposed to have some kind of attachment to from previous installments, and it really doesn't matter.
Well, and maybe it's going to matter. I mean, this is the thing. This is clearly set up for numerous films in the future, so maybe things are going to matter. Like, for instance, John Turturro's character.
That's an other
which
one.
Was like, what is he doing? What, like, where, what is any of this happening? And then
he,
like,
literally phones in his performance
literally from Cuba.
Cuba.
But then on top of that, he's sort of bestowed something
right
that has zero impact on this film.
That's
so
right.
So clearly, like, there's so much setup for the future films. And then I understand we're talking about a Bumblebee film coming out, which...
That's next year.
Don't necessarily understand why we need a Bumblebee film, because I'm pretty sure we've had five of them in a row.
Yeah.
I know you've said, oh, you know, Optimus Prime, he's your your main character. I'm like,
right.
It's really not. It's Bumblebee. Bumblebee
right.
is not only the main character, he's also the heart of... Yeah, I shouldn't really say he. I don't know. What do we call Transformers? Do they have gender?
That's a good question.
These are questions that will never be answered in a Michael Bay film.
That's right. No, there is a Bumblebee movie in the works, and it's supposed to take place in the 80s, so I hope they use that as an excuse to bring back the bug.
That would be great.
To put him in bug form. Not like insect bug. Yeah. For people who don't know the Transformers, he was a VW bug in the original.
Why are you listening to this if you don't know the Transformers?
Great point. I think that's part of it. There was actually a writer's room set up. They had a writer's room to lay out future storylines. And from what I understand, though, when they brought Michael Bay back, he was like, okay, so we have script one for this movie and script two for this movie. Which one do you want to do? And he's like, I want to do them both. And so that's what we get. I don't know how... that's what I've heard from rumor control. But, I mean, I understand your point about plotting and everything. It's just I think there's a sweet spot between this level of dumb and, like, maybe Fast and Furious level of dumb where you can get into it and you are with the characters and you can enjoy the action and you can enjoy the dumbness for what it is. I feel this is insultingly dumb. I feel like, I don't like the expression turn your brain off, because I don't think you should turn your brain off, but you can enjoy things without them having to have some sort of attached deeper meaning. This doesn't have to be, we reviewed Maudie last week. This doesn't have to be that.
No.
It doesn't have to be a character piece. I understand this is a big budget robot smash 'em up thing, but I do want things to make sense. I do want to see how we get from point A to B to C, and I don't want to have to be bogged down with all these Bayisms and bringing in exceptionally talented actors to act like they are high as a kite. I'm kind of sick of seeing, like, interesting, the Cuba thing, because it's set up as, like, Cuba is, like, a safe zone for Transformers.
Yeah.
And anywhere in the rest of the world, if you're a Transformer, you're going to get hunted down and destroyed or put in jail, apparently.
Yeah, there's a little Suicide Squad callback in this.
Yes, which is exactly what people were asking for. Which is weird. Because yeah, the previous four movies, Decepticons are destroyed and then, you know, torn apart for parts or whatever. In this movie, we have a Decepticon jail. And then
how are they being kept in there?
Anyway, that it's even though I think that might be an interesting idea to go into, like, how do you have a Decepticon jail? Mm-hmm. But no, that it's a gag for a minute so we can have Megatron come out and like, no, I want this guy released. Then the human lawyer's like, no, that guy's a psycho. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, the Cuba thing is interesting. The idea of, you know, Transformers, like, making their way to Earth, which is, of course, tied to the quote-unquote plot, and how, you know, more of them are coming. Because mm-hmm. every movie we get new Transformers, and it's like, well, where are they coming from? And this kind of tries to address that. And another thing I liked is they I don't know if it was tongue-in-cheek or what it was, but they did try to address the fact that there are fat Transformers. And why are there fat Transformers?
Yeah.
I'm not sure it was convincingly explained. And then another thing I did like, they finally, in a Michael Bay movie, mm-hmm. Michael Bay Transformers movie, we get a Buscemi cameo as a Transformer.
Oh, yeah. He was so good.
And it
was great.
Yeah, and it was kind of, I would have liked to have seen more of that guy, the day trader, who was like going around trading parts and things, and it was just a minute, and you immediately recognized the voice, and it was so great, and I'm glad Steve Buscemi finally found time in his schedule to record a Transformers voice. But it's interesting to talk about a robot fighting robot movie and talk about how there are not good parts, but it doesn't add up to a great whole, I think. And unfortunately, I find them diminishing in terms of mm-hmm. the returns. I like the first movie. Yeah. The third movie, I think, has its moments. Mm-hmm. I think especially when you see it in the big screen in 3D. I think that was probably the best big screen 3D Transformers mm-hmm. movie. But it just, the last one, if I kind of felt checked out on it, and this one, there are some redeeming qualities. I think this is better than part four.
Yeah.
But it just, I think it suffers from some of the same issues.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if they wouldn't have just been better off kind of rebooting a little bit mm-hmm. with Mark Wahlberg rather than trying to continue the story and somehow explain the WitWiki. I mean, that was kind of ham-fisted in this one too.
But, yeah.
You know, like, because I like Mark Wahlberg in these, and I think that he is the type of actor who's going to work really well with Michael Bay, who's really going to be able to do that action, comedy, and a little bit of overdramatic emotion.
Yeah, and it's, you know, Mark Wahlberg isn't, Mark Wahlberg has done some good acting, mm-hmm. but he is not someone you hire for acting. No. He has great charisma. He has definite screen presence. He can mix that, you know, comedy and still be believable as an action guy.
Yeah.
And so I think that would have made him perfect for these movies. But at the same time, I do wish there was maybe more of a focus on the actual Transformers as well, because I think the human drama is kind of what ankles this. And so you don't...
Yeah, I agree. I want less humans, more Transformers, but not more Transformers.
Right.
That's also been probably, you know, bringing in the Dinobots. I'm like, oh my God.
Who are wasted again.
Yeah, right. It's just like, can we just talk more about, you know, I kind of like the idea of trying to find out a little bit more about Cybertron and what happened and all that. Like, that would be interesting.
Maybe for part six.
Or seven or eight or nine.
Stay tuned for Transformers Forever. Well, we're going to have to wrap that up there. I don't know what to say about Transformers in summation. You're either going to see it or you won't. I think at this point you know what to expect.
I think they won't. I mean, honestly, there were maybe 50 people in the theater when I saw it mm-hmm. and its opening weekend. So.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it for this edition of End Credits, and we hope you liked it. And if you do like it, you can hear it again on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can also find us on social media, End Credits Radio Show on Facebook, End Credits Radio on Twitter. Candace, if people want to talk about Transformers some more, where can they find you?
You can find me on the internet at CINN48, that's CINN48. Just Google it and you'll find me on every medium.
Every medium.
All of them. Even the ones I don't check anymore.
MySpace. Anyway, I write about movies, TV shows, and all nerdy stuff every day at nerdbastards.com, and I will be back here on Thursday at 5 p.m. for news and politics on Open Sources Guelph, and that is with my partner there, Scotty Hertz. You can stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio, and we will be back here next Wednesday morning at 8 a.m. for more end credits, and we will see you then.